Greetings and salutations. Welcome to the Agile Revolution. Tony here.
And Craig.
And Craig's there. And we've got some special guests with us. Anthony Christensen. I'm going to call him Anthony because I'm Tony. And of course, we've got Steve Perez. And they're both with us talking about the new book, which I'll let them introduce. Steve.
Hello. Good to be here.
So fill us in the title of your new book.
Our book is called Doing Agile Right, Transformation Without Chaos.
Well, wouldn't we all hope for that?
I think we've all been in the chaos factor, but yeah.
We've all seen a lot of it.
Brilliant. And our other esteemed guest there is Mr. Christensen, who I know from many years back. How are you, Anthony?
I'm great, Tony. Thank you. I think the last person that called me Anthony was probably my mother when I was being very naughty, but it'll do fine for today's purposes.
Anthony, got it.
So as we jump in, just before we do jump in, I've got to give you the side note of one of the greatest. So we try not to be too, you know, date specific, but let's just use the COVID pandemic. Tony has one of the best stories around about if you have to get caught in the pandemic. Tony?
Yes, I guess if you have to get caught in isolation, you may as well get isolated in paradise. I found myself in a interesting scenario where for certain admin reasons, I needed to come back to Australia for a 3-week trip, and finished up the business I needed to undertake 2 days before COVID hit, and as a result, I'm forced to isolate in Australia for several months because of cancelled flights. But what a perfect place to be isolating in a country that is doing really well against the fight, and at the same time lapping up some of the beautiful surf coastline of Australia. So yes, it's a good time and place in a tragic situation.
Yeah, worst places to be, I'm sure, Tony. So tell us a little bit about yourself, gentlemen, for those who don't know you or haven't read the book. So, Steve, tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into this whole Agile domain.
Absolutely, Craig. Happy to. So I'm a partner with Bain & Company, which is a global management consulting firm, I am one of the folks who started our enterprise technology practice about 20 years ago. For most of the last decade, I've been working with firms around agile transformation. So helping their technology functions initially, but then over time, helping more and more of the company become agile. We found that just working with the software organization, the IT organization, wasn't enough really to create agility for the company, and we took things much, much broader. I work across a range of industries, spend a lot of my time in healthcare these days, but probably done this kind of work across many industries.
Thanks, Dave. And what about you, Tony?
My career has sort of spanned from back when technology was simple and there were about three roles involved in technology and Agile wasn't even on the lips of anyone, all the way through to today, where I've spent the last 15 years helping organizations switch to better working practices and to essentially learn key lessons about how to unpick the complexity of the worlds we've created for ourselves and focus back in on being responsive and customer focused and making it a delightful place for people to work and operate. And this has spanned a couple of different industry sectors, telcos and finance industry, but it's largely where I've spent the last most enjoyable part of my career, helping people understand how to do less stupid things today than they did yesterday.
Excellent. All right, so that sort of brings us to the book. Primarily, while we latched on to having a chat with you because you just launched the book, I guess, gentlemen, or Steve particularly, what was the driver for this particular book? What was the instance to say I want to put this in print?
Not as if there's any shortage of Agile books out there, is there?
That's right. Yeah,
there is no shortage of Agile books, but we saw a shortage in some aspects of thinking around Agile. So first of all, let me say that this book was written with two co-authors, Daryl Rigby and Sarah Elk. And the three of us have been working for years with dozens, even hundreds of companies around the world in our client base. We saw a number of companies get tremendous benefits out of Agile, and it was clearly something that could make the lives of customers and employees and even executives much, much better than before they were using Agile and they were in more bureaucratic traditional models. But we saw much more what I'll call bad Agile, doing Agile wrong, and a lot of pain and suffering as a result. So not only was it were those companies not getting the benefits of Agile, they were probably worse off than when they started in many cases. They were taking the organizations through these massive, you know, top-down, bureaucratic, quote, Agile transformations, but it was the opposite of Agile in terms of how they were implementing them and the values that they were following. So we just saw a big opportunity to try to share some of that learning and try to get Agile on the right track with a much broader group of companies. You know, if things continue the way they are, we're worried that Agile is just going to get a bad name and become a fad and go the way of things like re-engineering and quality circles. So we're hoping the book can really have a big impact on organizations broadly around the world.
Yeah, it's interesting, I guess. I wonder whether in some circles that bad name, or not the bad name, but I guess almost been there and tried that is already occurring. But it's interesting if you sort of look just even through the flip through the contents of the book, you know, the topics you go into, you know, around scaling and leadership, planning and budgeting, organization structures. I mean, these aren't new problems, you know. Tony, you were sort of alluding to before, right? You've been around this for a long time, you know, way before this was even a thing. What is it that you know, is making this you know, far more relevant for organizations in this day and age?
I think that when you look at the history of the Agile movement starting, the uptake in different sectors of the world, you know, the US first, where it was essentially incubated, and my observation was it took off in the Southern Hemisphere probably faster than it did in the UK and Northern Hemisphere areas. If you look at that, you see that the enthusiasm for what Agile promised was something that percolated and grew quite nicely, but it started to hit what I call the organizational boundaries beyond which, unless there was change in the systems of organizations, the way in which their processes, their governance, their culture, their leadership, the way in which they structurally align themselves, that Agile couldn't get any traction any further. In fact, often a lot of the initiatives that I was observing or involved with were deemed to fail and therefore generate bad experiences, because essentially the conditions for which it flourishes needed to change in order for it to go beyond Agile at team level or teams of teams to scaling at an enterprise level. And in fact, helping an organization become higher performant in every dimension. So, you know, achieving business agility as opposed to technology agility. And now I guess my where we're at is there's been enough experience in trying and attempting to scale and enough observations that can be made about things that are preconditions that are needed in order for Agile to be able to thrive, that you could classify and somewhat draw upon as patterns that help successfully do agile and achieve the benefits of agile across a much larger scale than just simply teams. And I think the book actually helps reference some of those key stories and learnings.
So interesting. One of the things I pick up on is, and it is one of the things that, you know, the likes of Craig and myself have dealt with many times, is, you know, it's around the CFOs and around how they are looking at the budgeting and the purse strings. Because let's face it, when you do a, I hate to use that word, transformation, but any kind of agile uplift, the reality is as you start to apply the agility factor, you're going to bang into the traditional funding cycles. And I'm interested in your thoughts in that after reading some of the stuff in the book. Steve, your thoughts on that?
Well, the reason why we see many organizations with a lot of agile software teams, but not that many agile software organizations, if I can make that distinction, is because there are a lot of things that are outside the four walls of the IT or software group that are required to make agile work. And funding is one of the most common of those things. So we know that persistent product teams are a really effective way to do software development. You know, clearly, a lot of digital natives organize their software development in that way. And we're trying to help companies in more traditional industries get many of those benefits. So a good example, one of the examples we talk about in the book related to funding is Royal Bank of Scotland. You actually probably have the top expert on that agile transformation on the podcast right now. That's Tony. It was a key driver of that transformation. And one of the impediments there was the funding. The way that money was allocated to projects with very specific scope, and that scope had to be followed and executed whether or not it turned out to be just what the customers wanted or not. When RBS moved to a model of funding persistent teams more around business outcomes and letting the teams have a lot more flexibility about how to achieve those outcomes, that made a real difference on what they were able to achieve.
Yes, that raises an interesting question. I mean, whether it, certainly when you talk about institutions like the Royal Bank of Scotland or any established organisation that's been around for a while, sort of tearing down those, sometimes hundreds of years of, this is the way we've done business, this is the way we've funded things, is one of the biggest challenges that people face when they're trying to implement or do an agile uplift, using Tony's words. So what sort of things are you both experiencing and actually trying in those organizations? Because I'm sure a lot of our listeners, that's where a lot of their struggle is. They struggle with the how to get through to the CFOs, how to change the funding models, how to change the, we need to put up a massive business case before we start a piece of work. What's some of your advice around that?
So I might offer some thoughts for Steve. I found that most organizations have a degree of dissatisfaction with the way in which their financial models work, either as a consumer or as a as the group that administers that, whether it be finance or investment groups. This is largely the symptoms that we see in most organizations that find that they are in a typical pattern that has evolved, such as annual planning cycles, where you need to predict what outcomes and value you want to deliver long before, often 6 months or earlier, before the money is then provided for you to then to start to experiment on those initiatives and deliver. And as we know, one of the things about Agile is to try and reduce that level of uncertainty by having continuous and incremental knowledge gathering and early learnings that allow us to determine, is this still the right thing to invest in and still the right thing to do? So the conversations that that are able to be held with your finance partners and your investment portfolio managers, if it's focused on what are the pain points that they see, and it's typically around trust and confidence in, if I give this money, will that money yield what your business case says it will yield? If you have a frank conversation, it invariably turns out to be there's a low degree of trust, which is why there's a high degree of rigor of the governance of the process around distributing money. And so given that level of trust and confidence in, will I get back what I've what you promised for this money, it allows you to then say, so is there a better way? Is there a better way where if we could structure the distribution of funds such that we have regular early visibility of, are we seeing the promise of this return? So if you think about Eric Ries's book, The Lean Startup, where the concepts have moved away from making a big business case, seeking venture capital investment, and then your spreadsheet predicted that by year three you would be in the multi-billions return, only to find that one figure in the first 3 months of your execution suddenly makes that whole spreadsheet drop down to an unprofitable outcome, and then they collapse it all. Moving more towards, what's the least amount of money we can invest to experiment and learn, is this the right thing to invest in and operate, suddenly starts to spark the interests of the financial teams and the investment teams. Similarly, there's a conversation that's able to be held around the traditional separation of operational budgets and their management from investment and change budgets. And again, there's these two things are in natural tension with each other. Where typically it's a one leader motivated and driven by cost reduction, the other one is motivated and driven by adding to the operational costs because they're putting new change in. If you then start to hold a conversation around, well, shouldn't the net of those two things actually be managed by one person? So in your own household, do you have one person that's responsible for discretionary spend, holidays and restaurant spend, and the other that's responsible for maintaining the house and the car and everything else? And if the car breaks down, do you just say, ah, oh, forget it, we're still going on holiday? Or do you say, we actually need to fix the car, so we'll spend less on the holiday? So if you start to bring sort of focus in on how to solve problems to create a better outcome, those conversations with the financial teams and the investment teams becomes easier, and it starts to unlock then, well, how do we do this? So that would be my that has been my experience in the last 10 years. Sorry, Steve.
Dave?
Yeah, no, that's great, Tony. Getting senior executives on board with Agile is often one of the most challenging things to do, and one of the most important. It's certainly possible to get good value and good performance from Agile teams without that. But usually, if you can't get senior management on board at some point, you start running into roadblocks that just can't get clear to get you to the next level of performance. So, you know, the funding model is a good example. If you have to keep going through large business cases and fixed project scope, that you're only going to be able to get so far. If you are trying to build a strong engineering culture and you want to be able to reward technical skill, not just managerial scope, but your human resources function isn't willing to get on board with the changes that will be needed, you know, that can be a barrier. If your legal and compliance function in a bank or a pharmaceutical company insists on reviewing all the software changes for a month before you can release it, you know, that's not very effective. So so getting senior management on board really is important at some point in the process. And we usually see that being done just by demonstrating the value and the success of Agile in various different places in the company, and then just trying to get more and more senior people to see that, to appreciate it, until finally it becomes clear it's just a better way to innovate.
Yeah, that the interesting thing about the book too, I was reading through the book, Steve, and it does go across the gamut. So I'm interested. We talk about it a lot here. That, you know, obviously it's no brainer that where Agile started in software, but it certainly has expanded itself across the organizations. And usually your juncture point is now where it's the whole or the holistic view of the organization adopting it, as opposed to small pockets, because they reach their terminal velocity, if you like, where they can't go any further because that pocket bangs up against these organizational constructs. So I'm interested in your thoughts on that, gentlemen.
So the use of Agile in places outside software development.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. So we're seeing that more and more, and in a way that's the bigger untapped potential, just because Agile is reasonably well penetrated in software these days. We know there's room for improvement there, but it's kind of a greenfield in a lot of other places for product development and process innovation. So, a good example would be a company like Bosch, which is a global technology consumer. They've got a giant auto parts business, a power tool business. There are a lot of different businesses. They found that they just were not innovating as rapidly as they wanted to and needed to. And that was both in their products, but also in the way they actually ran the business, their processes. So they've been on an Agile journey for several years, using Agile in all sorts of places, everything from product design of power tools to manufacturing processes and the way that they conduct supply chain operations, and really very broadly, there's very much of a senior management engagement there, and they see Agile being used any place that change is required. Now, that doesn't mean, by the way, and one of the themes in the book is that Agile is not for everything. One of the places we see Agile go wrong is not that you can't get the attention of senior management, it's that you've actually gotten too much of their attention and they want to convert the entire company to Agile. So we're going to pay invoices and close our books using Agile teams. We're going to have our sales teams become Agile teams and so forth. And for us, Agile is the most effective way to innovate. But when it comes to actually operating the business, more traditional methods of clear roles and documented processes and so forth are actually pretty effective. You don't necessarily want experimentation with the person at a hamburger restaurant trying to cook the hamburger for 2 minutes less and seeing if that's going to make anybody sick or not, right? So that is a place we see Agile go wrong. But when it comes time to designing new hamburgers and new product offerings, that's a really good use of Agile.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things as I was reading through the book, you know, there was lots of sort of moments where I went, yes, you know, that's a thank you for saying that type of a thing, in lieu of any book that I have out in the market right now. But I think one of the things that resonated with me that I actually haven't seen, but I don't see people talk about enough, is that when we talk about taking an organization on an Agile transformation, you've alluded to the fact in the book that essentially the best way to manage that transformation is by doing it in an Agile way. And yet I see so many organizations fall into this, you know, very traditional, you know, planned kind of approach, right? You know, we're going to do this in 3 months and we're going to make sure we get it all right before we roll it out. What's some thoughts from both of you on your experience there? Because people seem to want to, you know, I mean, we are dealing with people here, right? So, you know, people don't want to upset that, because people don't deal with change terribly well. But on the same token, we tend to not practice what we preach.
So I think the thing to remember is that most organizations that are wanting to drink from the Kool-Aid and get the benefits that, that they've seen others achieve with applying Agile and Agile practices is they're operating within a traditional projectized and programized funding model itself. So the transformation initiatives essentially have to be funded initially through the current traditional mechanisms that have an expected scope, time frame, and outcome. So the art and the science of this, so that you can achieve an organization that operates within that framework, but is changing that framework as a result of what it's investing in the change, is that you need to be quite skillful as to how to upwardly manage and stay, if you like, within your current governance frameworks whilst you're changing the governance frameworks. So it's a realization that I came to very early on, that there's no point in trying to beat the door down and say, to become agile, you need to loosen the constraints you have on me. Instead, to gain credibility, you need to operate within the tolerances and expectations of those currently in control as you bring them through the changes that they might need to apply to adapt to making the organization more responsive, faster to support customer outcomes, faster to even improve COG outcomes. And so it's changing the system from within the system is really the key there.
Yeah, I guess just the point on that, so absolutely agree with what you say there. One of the things that happens though is that once you unleash that little bit, once you find that first team that that dives across the line, once you see that first success, then everybody wants to go extremely fast. But if you're still stuck in that traditional thing, then you end up with this thing where the higher level management, and then you know the people on the ground, and then the folks in the middle layer are all talking a different language, and they're all pointing at each other as to where the problem is. So whilst you sort of get through that, how do you then move out of that type of issue occurring?
We talk about one of the phenomenons of doing Agile wrong by saying, you know, let's have you folks do Agile, you know, where you get the senior manager who reads the book, reads the article, hears from one of their buddies on the golf course about how great Agile is, and they spin up a giant program, program office, they, you know, design a big transformation. Often they're copying some other company and figuring out that they can just make that work in their company. And then
let's be like Spotify.
Exactly. Let's all be like Spotify. I mean, if you ask the folks at Spotify, they think there is no Spotify model, and please do not copy us. You know, it's not going to work. It works because we have a culture and an architecture and all sorts of things that are specific to us. The phenomena of, you know, everybody kind of pointing to each other and going, well, this is your fault, whatever. I mean, we usually see that in these big bang, top down, you know, anything but agile, agile transformations. Where agile works well, it's more organic. You enable teams, you let them experiment, you let them learn from each other, you let the demand build, and you give them the tools for success as a senior leader, but then you kind of get out of the way and you know, let the teams experiment and improve and learn from each other. So, you know, we do believe some amount of structure is valuable, especially if you're working on products that require many teams to coordinate, whether those are software products or SOB engineering building the Gripen fighter, which is the most cost-effective fighter jet in modern history, was done purely through agile means, but it required hundreds of agile teams to coordinate. So there had to be some degree of coordination to make that happen. But the more that we let teams follow agile principles of self-direction and learning and trust, the better results we're going to get.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I really like, and that just to, sorry, I heard you talk there, Tony. I'll just pick up on that. I really like that piece that you're actually talking about, the self-directed agile teams, where they still need those boundaries. So I think that's a really good pick up on that. Tony, you had a comment on that as well?
Yeah, I think that that one of the common success patterns that you see is where an organization has attempted to change itself by taking a focus in on an end-to-end value stream, you know, a total encapsulation of one particular slice of the business end-to-end, generated successes and learnings out of that, and then expanded that rapidly through the rest of the organization. And there is always that immediate desire that if you've seen success end-to-end in one part, then we want to expand it everywhere immediately. And part of the recipe for failure is where you try to, even within your company, take that slice and replicate it exactly as is across each other slice of the organization. The more successful approaches that I've seen and that we've seen is that where you essentially get your proof point end to end, and then focus the organization not on how to implement that as an agile pattern across the whole organization, but take the lessons from that and set the ambition of becoming a learning organization that's constantly evolving and adapting from its own internal successes. So what worked with that first transition and this new way of working, and what might be applicable to the next, that is reuse and constant sharing and learning networks being created. That's one of the key recipes for how to, if you like, virally expand in a sustainable way, where there's no end state that we're looking for. It's just a better state than we're in today, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess just picking up on that and coming back to, we sort of joked before about the Spotify approach, but I guess one of the things that I often reflect on that is that I think that went so viral because they were one of the few organizations that actually shared not only what they were doing, but how they did it. And for a lot of people, and reading through the book, you allude to some of the things, like diagram sort of, you know, halfway through the book about, you know, perhaps, you know, what team structures might look like in the book, and you rarely see people actually sharing those kinds of things. And I think the reality is that I'm sure you've all worked with lots of organizations, and there's been lots of you know, good approaches and bad approaches, but, you know, I wonder whether things like Spotify have been successful just because actually somebody went out there and said, here's a radical thing that we tried that in some ways worked. And so when people are looking for the answer, right, they're often looking for, as you alluded to before, Tony, the recipes. So I'm wondering, how do we as a community you know, help people a little more with that? Because I think a lot of people are just, you know, trying to go, yes, yeah, so we want to experiment with things, but we need some recipes to start with. Like any good cook, you need to start with a recipe and then you start to playing around with it.
Yeah. Go ahead, Danny.
So I guess Spotify wasn't the first to share. You know, when you think about Toyota, they openly throw their doors for all competitors and anyone to come and observe what's going on. I think that we do see a great deal of sharing going on, but perhaps to your point, not as much as we would really like. And sharing the recipes actually doesn't place you at a competitive disadvantage, because you're always ahead of the people that are then going to start to practice some of the recipes and patterns that you've evolved. In my view, it is of extreme benefit to in industry, to our colleagues in the change field, to share promiscuously with each other. Even, you know, this podcast today is an example of trying to share as much knowledge as possible without fear of it actually being placing us in an anti-competitive, impacting our revenue streams. The more that you can share, the more that you can actually help other people learn and adapt, the better the world will become and the more responsive it will become, particularly when you think about the current scenario that we're in with this global pandemic. Organizations that are able to adjust rapidly to all dimensions of it, whether it be the office environments, the home environments, the caring for people, etc., they are best placed to be able to then survive the disruptive challenges. So sharing promiscuously is something that I hope continues, sharing these patterns and these recipes.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah. I want to take it a little bit differently now and ask you it's not a controversial question, but I always ask this of people when they write their books. And we've interviewed a number of people who've got books or they've done, the thing or the paper and say, okay, you've done that, you've got it out, which, I'm in awe of that because I haven't done that either. And you keep saying you're going to do that. So kudos to you. But I'm always wondering, once you've got it out there, what did you miss? What do you think that you missed that you should have put in the book that you could talk about now?
Because the book's great. Let's just be really clear about that. The book's really good.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. One thing is that, of our three authors, Daryl comes at Agile from the standpoint of having led our innovation practice for many years. And Sarah leads our organization and leadership practice, and I lead our technology practice. So we come at it from three different angles, and we specifically wrote a book that could be approachable to a very broad audience. There was a lot more technical depth that I had hoped to get into the book that we decided not to include because we wanted it to be approachable to folks that weren't technical, that weren't necessarily using Agile for software. That's part of what content we have we didn't put in the book, but the good news is we put a lot of that on our website. So the book has an accompanying website, bain.com/doing-agile-write. And if you go there, you can find some deeper content on the things you need to do to make software development effective besides the core Agile practices. So that's one thing that we've included. Secondly, we have a lot more examples of companies that have done Agile well or are in the process of doing Agile well. I had a number of companies, a large healthcare company, a global equipment manufacturer, a large airline, that at the time we were having to finalize the book content, they weren't quite ready to declare themselves a public success. But where they're now getting to that point where they are ready to say, yes, we're confident we can talk about this because we see it's working and we can be very proud of it. So we're going to be, over the coming months, be putting more named case examples on the website. And that's another way we're going to try to make this much more living content. You can't write a book about Agile and expect it to have everything, because we know, every single day we're all learning, we're growing, we're improving. And the idea is we're trying to create some community around the website, as well as a group we call the Agile Enterprise Exchange, which right now is several dozen companies that do the kind of best practice sharing that Tony was talking about.
So we've had Craig's having a bit of an audio issue there, so I'll jump in. Yeah, I think that's fantastic. I always ask that question, and the reason I ask that question is because I know, as you said, you write a book about Agile or things move, or there's the stuff that ends up on the cutting floor, and then you go, oh, I should have brought that in. So thank you for that. Craig, you had a question?
Yeah, didn't know how to use the mute button. One last thing, as I was reading through the book, that coming back to the content is that you sort of make the statement about pertinent cross-functional teams and keeping teams together. One of the things, though, that I've been coming across a lot lately as I've been talking to CIOs and CTOs is this fear of the and you're alluding to before, I think, Steve, the business as usual or not changing the operational model. And as a result, when particularly when you look at IT teams, they also have that operational type aspect. You know, they've got to keep a certain level of keeping the lights on. And as a result, there's been a lot of discussion lately about whether you actually form teams and put all the members in that team and keep them together, which has been what a lot of agile folks have said, versus actually having a team of engineers over here in a pool that you kind of pull in and out. And I find a lot of IT departments, particularly particularly in probably your smaller to medium sized organizations, perhaps where those resources aren't as flush as they would like them to be, really struggle with this idea of a team that's actually committed. I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts around that, because it's a common problem that we've had a bit of mail in the last little while.
Sure. Well, we generally work with relatively large companies, but I think that these principles can apply to different size companies. With software teams in particular, we see a real benefit to what we call converged backlogs, where development, maintenance, and support of a given set of systems are done by the same teams. It's really very supportive of DevOps principles and ensuring that as teams write features, they're also thinking about the architecture and the operations of those systems. And when they're the ones that are called at 2 a.m. when something's not working, they're going to be more likely to take the time to make sure the non-functional requirements are also there. The model that we've seen most companies find effective is that model of persistent teams mapped against portions of the application footprint, often organized by customer experience, and that's a whole separate discussion, but sometimes organized by business capability. And it's true that at different times, different parts of that footprint are more important than others for change and innovation. And there you can move people around. You can say, well, we had 3 teams on our, retail merchandising systems last year, but now we know we need to do a lot of innovation in that area. We're going to add a 4th team and split the work around and so forth. So there is some ability in this model to move people where they're more needed. But we find that most organizations or large organizations are able to keep 70 to 80% of those teams persistent from one year to the next. So they get the benefits of really deep knowledge of particular systems in that process. Doesn't mean you can't take some, if you have 3 really good data scientists, sure, you may move them to the place you need to build a complex AI model this month, but not next month. You will do a certain amount of that, and especially a smaller organization, as you say, that may not be as flush with talent in some cases. But it doesn't mean you still can't get the benefits for most of the people working on more persistent problems.
It's actually quite a significant economic argument for persistent teams. We're all familiar with the forming, storming, norming, performing paradigm, where teams, when they're first brought together, take a while to get into a rhythm, a pattern, and a level of productivity, and then hopefully they're together long enough that they get into high levels of productivity. And this has got to do with familiarity with the challenge that they're working on together, familiarity with each other, et cetera, et cetera. But there's a 5th dimension to that that's not often talked about, which is a direct result of the project management paradigm, which is it goes through storming, forming, norming, performing, and then mourning, because your team is broken up and you've completed that task and you're now being redispersed to other initiatives. And when you study the economic impact of this, there is a slow ramp-up rate, so there's a high cost to getting a team to a state that it's high performing. And then you collapse the team and you lose the IP and in some cases it even leaves the organization, not just that team, but it wanders out the door. So there is this high cost to business of this projectized model of ramp up, collapse, ramp up, collapse. So one of the when you say, well, okay, so what's the answer to that? The answer is obviously to try and create persistent teams that become high performing. They get through that whole cycle, but they miss the mourning part. They lament the breakup of the team. The art and the science of that is actually, how do you structure persistent teams? What's the work that they will be doing that is a consistent, continuous backflow of work? Now, yes, you do need specialists that, I'll call it roles and tasks which are higher impact, less frequency, that come in and out of initiatives. But for the most part, what you want to try and do is create persistent teams around persistent bodies of work. That requires an understanding and a study of what is the work that the organization is doing and realigning the organization to a consistent value stream of work. So persistency of teams has some preconditions, but some extremely high benefits if you can achieve it.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, Craig and I talk about that a lot, that morning stage, and we've all been through it, I think, if we've worked with teams as well, right? So, Craig, you had a really good question. I think we're getting close to the end, gentlemen, but we don't want to miss out on the question that Craig's going to ask.
Yeah, one of the things I was trying to figure out as I was preparing for this, where I actually knew Steve from, and it was actually an article I'd read just recently about agile powering healthcare, and you alluded to before that you do a lot of work in that space. And obviously, you know, 2020 has been a year where we've been through a lot of disruption in so many ways. We don't need to go into that so much, but it's really put a spotlight on healthcare. This article was obviously written before pandemic happened, but I'm also in, and I know Tony also spends time working with people in different parts of the health industry. I'm just wondering if you have any sort of thoughts or insights, given sort of where we are about the fact that about how Agile is doing in that space and what we can probably do more of as an Agile community.
That's a great question, and I'm working today with one of the largest U.S. healthcare providers, as well as one of the large global pharmas and vaccine companies. So both of these firms are seeing the need to innovate at a much more rapid pace in the last few months than they've ever really had to deal with, both in delivering healthcare and then working on treatments and hopefully ultimately a vaccine. What's really interesting is that when companies face those situations, they naturally move to agile practices. They form small, dedicated teams. They give them very specific, high priority problems to work on, a lot of leeway for how to solve them. They break the barriers and the bureaucracy to empower them to do it. And we're seeing that in healthcare in a big way. And those firms that were already beginning to use agile principles are leveraging them more heavily, but even those that weren't are beginning to just do them naturally. So we're focused not only on making those more effective now, but also helping those companies think, how can they maintain that agility after the crisis passes too? How can they hold on to those benefits? And that ties into a big theme of the book, which is becoming an agile enterprise. It's not just having agile teams, it's building the whole business systems around agility, from the way that strategy is formulated, to the leadership and culture, to planning and budgeting, to the talent engine, and of course the technology. So we see that happening in healthcare in a big way right now because of the needs. But hey, same needs in grocery and travel and a lot of other companies that are having to adjust their business models very rapidly. So, we're actually having originally had some trepidation to launching doing Agile right in the middle of a global pandemic. We're finding it's actually an incredibly good time to be talking about this subject, and we're finding a great deal of interest because of that.
I think if there's any silver lining, you found the right time to get that out there. So well done.
We are all silver linings today, but
yeah, well, I guess a good friend of mine said, just to add a note to that, is that, you know, all teams are agile teams at the moment because of the way they've had to work from home, right?
Yes.
Exactly. Even if they weren't, they are now.
Or in Tony's cases, you know, stuck on a beach somewhere.
Yeah, well, yeah. Tough life. Gentlemen, we've reached the end, and it's been a really good conversation, and we've really enjoyed that with you. As we reach the end with all of our people that join us on this, we have a little thing that we like to do.
Well, before that, Tony, I guess if people want to know some more, firstly, if they want to find out more about you, Tony, where do they, or Anthony, where do they find out more about you?
I did forget that, didn't I?
You did.
The obvious first place to look would be LinkedIn, but I'm also contactable as I'm part of the Bain Advisory Network now. So through their local Bain consultants, they can also reach out to me directly on AussieAgilista@gmail.com. So I welcome anyone that wants to learn more or share stories or even share current grievances. I'm not a bad shoulder to cry on.
Excellent. Thanks, Tony. And Steve, people want to find out more about you?
Just go to Bain.com, Doing Agile Right. You'll find out about the book. You'll find out about me. You can contact me or other authors at the website. And we love hearing from people.
Excellent. And the book's available both in print and electronic copy, I assume?
It is, and also an audiobook. So, and
oh, wow.
any flavor you like to consume.
I have to ask the question, did the authors record the audio book or was it done by somebody else?
It was done by a professional. you know, I was hoping to get, you know, Barack Obama, but done by a professional recorder. But, you know, I enjoyed it.
Excellent. Yeah, and I guess the last thing on the book is that it's one of those things that it packs a lot of content into a reasonably short and easy read. So it's not one of those 700 page tomes you have to get through. There's a lot of content in a reasonably easily digestible form. So it's the kind of book you can read in. I used to say the kind of book you could read in a couple of plane flights, but that doesn't seem relevant right now. So
I do concur because I consumed it quite quickly. You know, obviously extended a copy to us so that we could read it. And it was an easy read. I think you got that right, Craig.
Well, thank you.
Hey. And obviously, Tony Ponton, if people want to find out more about you, where do they find you?
You can find me at tony@theagilerevolution.com. And Craig, where can they find you?
I'm at craig@theagilerevolution.com. Now, Tony, back to where you were going.
Back to where I was going. You know, we've been doing this for how many times? Almost 200 podcasts. I still can't get it right. So what we do with everybody who finishes up when we finish our podcast is we really like to get you to join us in our little Viva La Revolution. It's the way we like to finish it because we like to say we're going to continue keeping this going. So after the count of three, gentlemen, if you'd like to join us, that'd be fantastic. One, two, three. Viva La Revolution. Oh, come on, gentlemen. It's got to be better than that.
Yeah, right? Steve and Tony together on the count of three.
All right.
One, two, three.
Viva la revolution!
Yeah, there we go. That's the way. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay. Guys, I really admire what you do. I'm looking forward to continuing to follow you.